I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Marcus Follin, the Golden One. Marcus, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, especially a pleasure to be on Countercurrents Radio, since I tend to read Countercurrents on the webpage almost every single night, actually, looking for new articles. So yeah, great influence on me and a great source of intellectual stimulation. So thank you for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Well, thank you. I've known you for years now. I followed you for years, and I was very excited that you recently brought out a book called Dauntless, a handbook for the quest for enlightenment and glory. So I want to talk about that book today. I'd like to talk a bit about your intellectual background and your influences, how you came to be who you are as a white advocate, if you even use that term. And also, I'd like to talk a bit about some of the latest issues you've been tackling, namely the appalling amount of violence that's being directed by largely migrant people in Sweden against young Swedish men. So let's just begin with some of your influences and your intellectual journey. How did you become who you are?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I've always been interested in history. That was my first perspective on multiculturalism, basically, because we've had in Sweden, as everyone might imagine, quite a bit of propaganda ever since I have been alive. I'm born in 89, for the record. So basically, when I started thinking about multiculturalism, and I thought to myself, this obviously does not work. And I noticed that even without any real life experiences of the bad sides of the multicultural project. So it was more a historical analysis, because history is to a large extent about different peoples in the vicinity of each other competing for the territory. So I thought it was quite stupid, the whole concept. And I was about 17 when I started to delve deeper into it to see, okay, what's the next step? So the first step of my enlightenment journey was the multicultural side of things. And then, of course, came, you know, race realism and a lot of other things. So, and I mean, I'm 30 now and I'm still continuing along my journey to enlightenment. And yeah, as I said, I will once again mention Countercurrents, that have gained plenty of insights over the years from just reading there. Especially in terms of culture as well, which I've been more interested in as of late. To quote Breitbart, who said it, that politics is downstream from culture. And of course, when I was 17, I just thought everything could be solved via politics. But yeah, as we know now, it's also about metapolitics and how important that is.
Exactly. I appreciate your stand on that. You always take a very, very congenial stand on the importance of getting ideas right and building community and things like that before we actually get into the political. And really, if you don't get the metapolitical foundations right, you're just sort of LARPing, you're play acting, like yeah, you're engaged in politics, but you don't actually have the basis for engaging in politics. It's sort of like pretending that the stick that you're waving around is actually a sword, because you haven't provided yourself with a sword yet.
Yeah, exactly. And a very good example of this is the Swedish political system. We never had a cultural Marxist party that got 50% of the votes. But as it is right now, they won the battle of ideas during the late 60s, 70s, 80s, and they just took over academia, culture. They won in every non-political arena. They won, and now we have all of the political parties basically are heavily influenced by their ideas. So as it is right now, a few years ago, I came to the conclusion that the most I can do is not necessarily purely political, but rather getting ideas out there, and they can in turn influence how people will act in 10 years, for example.
Right. So how long have you been doing YouTube videos? That's where I first heard about you, was on YouTube.
Yeah, that's always been my main forum for spreading my ideas. So basically, I started in 2013, and then it was mainly a fitness channel. That's how it all started. And it took till about late 2014 when I started talking a bit more about politics, since I had been pro-European, pro-Swedish since I was 17. So I always had it, and I always knew that there would come a time where I had to start talking about some of the issues. So and then in 2015, the great migration crisis, then I really started talking more about politics because it was a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. I first remember you coming on my radar at the end of 2014, maybe the beginning of 2015. That was a time for me when a lot of things started happening. At the end of 2014, I started seeing our traffic go way up. That was when I met a lot of people connected with the right stuff. That's when I was in New York. There was all this energy circulating around. I was making new connections. That's when I started watching Millennial Woes. That's when I heard about you. So yeah, that was about the time that you came on board. And the migrant crisis really was a galvanizing thing for a lot of people. In the United States, the thing that started the rise of traffic really was the Black Lives Matter movement. First, it was Trayvon Martin, and then it was Mike Brown and Black Lives Matter, and that kind of stuff really, I think, jolted a lot of white people awake, and they started looking for alternatives. And then the migrant crisis started doing that for people in Europe. And really, we've been riding that wave for a long time. And then when Trump came into the game in, what was it, June of 2015, there was another spike in interest. So that was a great time. That was a very, very exciting time.
Yeah, it was. It was. It truly was. 2016, I have like a total just horizon and just an extreme amount of people you could red pill. And, you know, we had freedom of speech to a much larger extent. So, yeah, it was good times during 2016, I remember clearly.
Yeah, I hate to be so full of nostalgia for the recent past. You know, it's not a place where I want to be. I don't want to be looking backward. I don't want to feel like, gosh, those were the days and now everything is so cramped and constricted. But they really have been throwing a lot of shade in our way, a lot of repression in our way. It's been really, really hard recently. Has the censorship and deplatforming affected you in particular?
Yeah, it has. And I will just say, though, that when I think about, I of course also want to look to the future, but what I can say is that I'm so happy and grateful that I could have, that I was active during that time. So 2015, 16, 17, I wouldn't want to have become enlightened today and see that I missed my opportunity. So I will always be thankful for, you know, having had an impact when it was possible to reach the most people. So for me, yeah, I got demonetized completely in June last year. And then I've seen my reach and my growth has been severely limited. So I still have my YouTube channel and you can watch my videos if you want. But it's not the same as it was before when I could just calculate, okay, now I will reach 10,000 more subscribers in the next 2 months. Now it's just, I'm happy if I can reach out to the people I have. I was happy that I could reach 100,000 subscribers. So I had that as a, you know, long-term goal. But as it is right now, the algorithm, I'm not banned, but I'm shadow banned, you could say.
Right. So your book, Dauntless, is this something that you planned on for a long time, or was this just an attempt to find a new way of reaching an audience?
So basically, I started writing it quite early in 2015, and that's been, you know, I've always wanted to write a book, and I thought I want all of my thoughts, my teachings, my takes, my analysis in one place, so I can just direct people to, okay, here is my, read this if you want to have everything in one place. Then, of course, as time progressed, I was very happy that I had written so much of the book already because I saw where the censorship, where it was headed. And then I thought, okay, our physical book, if we get banned, deplatformed, everything, we can just go back to basics, what dissidents have done in all centuries. Yeah, you publish books, you distribute books, you get people to read them. And that's a very anti-fragile way to distribute ideas, a physical book. So as I view it right now, one of my primary goals is to just, yeah, get as many people to read a book as possible. And I can market it via my social media channels. It was good timing that I could release it when I could.
So let's talk a bit about the book. I want to talk about some of the specific topics you deal with, but also just sort of pull back and talk about some of your influences. You have a lot of advice for people in this book, which I like. You can take it or leave it, but it's out there. You put your opinions out there. You put your soul into this. Let's not talk about the stuff with the nuance yet. Let's just talk about the basic things that you think that everybody who's listening to your voice today should be doing, and a couple of the things that nobody should be doing. What are the right. thou shalts and the thou shalt nots of the golden one?
All right. So, if I stick to a few of them each. So thou shall, of course, I am a great proponent of, taking care of yourself, taking care of your body. It's a cool term, biohacking. I think that's a fun term to use. So basically, sleep, very important. Of course, this is no news for anyone, but I just want to really emphasize exactly how important sleep is for everything, basically, no matter if we're talking about cognitive function. If I want to make a video, if I want to make the most compelling argument possible, or if I want to hold a speech, the sleep is the most important thing, so I can just be ultra precise, ultra clear. The diet, of course, also plays into this. So it's easy to think that, you know, if someone is an athlete or a bodybuilder or something, that you must take care of your diet. But I would say everyone, especially those who do intellectual work, your diet is basically what fuels your brain. So sleep and diet for both athletic and intellectual work, I'd say. So everyone should take care of that. Then, of course, train. Everyone can't train the same, but do something physical at least once a day, especially if you are sitting down a lot. So it can just be a walk. I listen to podcasts when I walk, so it's a good time to just, you know, move around and also get some intellectual stimulation. Then, of course, you can also hit the gym if that's a possibility. I would say for all younger guys who are listening, if you have the time and possibility to hit the gym every day, you can do so. For anyone who's a bit older, perhaps it's hard to fit in gym every day, but you can at least go for some sort of walk in the sunshine. Plenty of good health benefits to doing so. So that's just some basic to-dos. And to not do, I would say, of course, pornography. It's an absolute, absolutely forbidden, especially for all younger guys, because you need to use that energy to improve yourselves as much as possible. And of course, you don't want to support the porn industry. So that's the first thing that everyone should just quit. Secondly, all sorts of bad addictions. I'm talking about nicotine, drugs, etc. So I'm not sure exactly if I'm quoting Thomas of Aquinas here or whomever it was, but he said every vice you have is a master, something like that. So don't have any addictions, don't have any vices. Easy to say, but I'm just, I'm throwing it out there anyway.
Okay, so rest, good diet, physical activity are the three basic things you ought to do. And then pornography and smoking and drugs are the things absolutely to avoid.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing that a lot of people claim is an addiction and that we simply should try and extirpate from our lives is gaming, role-playing games, using computers, things like that to do gaming. I have to say that I'm too old for that. I never got into that. It wasn't around in the way it is today when I was young. And so that whole world is, you know, terra incognita for me. So I'm immune to its appeal, basically. At least I kid myself and think that I am.
Right.
But there are a lot of people that I know who spend unimaginable amounts of time absorbed in this kind of role-playing gaming.
Yeah.
You have a somewhat nuanced view of this. So can you tell us the pros and cons of your take on gaming?
Yeah, so basically we can divide games into two categories. One is Counter-Strike or Dota, where you continuously play matches. So a match takes maybe an hour, and then you go and play another match after that. And that is what can make you truly make it into a true time sink. It's just, game after game after game. So that's one segment of all games. And that is, of course, to be avoided at all costs, because you want to get better at it. So you need to play more and et cetera. But then you have another segment of games, which can basically be said to you play a story. So, for example, I have started reading The Witcher, the books. So I'm four books in. So it's the Witcher books by Andrzej Sapkowski, a Polish author, wrote them in during the 90s. But I must say that playing The Witcher 3, the third game, is a better way to absorb that particular culture, because not only do you have the story, but you also have the medieval European feel, the Slavic feel, because you have the graphics in front of you, you have a lot of European aesthetics, you have a lot of really good music in the game, and the feel you get when you play the game, you play the story. And also, of course, you can play it several times, you can play through the story, but ultimately you play through the story to its end, and then it is basically finished. So it is more about a medium of getting in culture, which is not the case really with the games where you just play matches all the time. So I would say if you want to have a good injection of European aesthetics, of European culture, especially Slavic culture, Slavic folklore and mythology, The Witcher 3 is a absolutely great way to do so, even better than the books. And I'm saying this as someone who loves to read. So I would say it depends on the game. Some games are great and some games are completely detrimental. And it also depends, of course, on how you... I know also a lot of young guys, they perhaps skip training because they're gaming instead, which is, of course, very bad. So it's also about the individual, what you do with it.
Yeah, exactly. Friends of mine have said, is it a waste of time to read fantasy literature? And I had to say no. And a lot of them said, well, a lot of gaming is fantasy literature, and it's as absorbing as fantasy literature. It's as stimulating as fantasy literature. It's as moving as fantasy literature. It's literature that's more immersive than just reading it off the page, because it comes with music, it comes with images, and it allows you to actually take roles and play roles in this rather than just sort of be a spectator from the outside, which is what you do with a book or a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And it took me back a bit just reading your discussion of this. I thought, yes, this is very, very interesting. And you can learn a lot from it. So everything in moderation, I guess, including gaming, have some taste.
Yeah, exactly. And I must say that for me, Age of Empires 2, I started playing it when I was like 10 or 11, and it truly ignited my interest in history. Mm-hmm. So same thing with Total War. I've gotten great history lessons from games. And then also in terms of just cultural motivation, again, The Witcher or Skyrim, it's a good way to, well, you can reconnect somewhat with your own folklore. Skyrim is, of course, based on Vikings to a certain extent, so you get that. And if you compare it to a lot of Hollywood degeneracy, and anti-white Hollywood productions where there can be no strong white men. But in The Witcher and in Skyrim, you have plenty of strong white men, which the player can hopefully identify with. Now, of course, there is a problem also, which I mentioned in the book, and that's if some young guy use it as escapism. If he says, you know what, I can be a powerful hero in this game, so therefore I don't need to be a powerful hero in my own life. That's a danger of it as well. But for me, I've always, you know, I've always been into fantasy, always been into historical fiction, always been into gaming. And for me, I've always said, okay, cool, these guys who are being portrayed in this game, they're cool. I want to be like them. So I need to train now, or I need to do these sort of things. So it also depends on what kind of what you take away from the game. So hopefully what I'm trying to say is that you should get as much motivation from the game as possible.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a substitute for life. It can be a stimulation to life.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk a bit about literature. What are some of your favorite books? Who are some of your favorite authors? Who are the literary writers who have inspired you?
It's a good question. So I've read quite a bit over the years. Mainly, I would say, though, historical fiction, just because of my history interest. But in terms of more intellectual stuff, I mean, I like your books. I always read your articles on Countercurrents as well. I think they're always good and nuanced. Then in terms of other political books, I have been inspired by Guillaume Fay. I read Why We Fight quite early. I thought it was good. I read For My Legionaries by Cornelio Cudriano. I thought that was very inspiring as well. Then some of Evola's work. Then I'm perhaps not the biggest Evola fan, even though I've taken some of his teachings to heart, especially in terms of Riding the Tiger and in terms of racial materialism. And that's actually a very interesting discussion regarding race, that, you know, there are a lot of white people, but there's a lot of Swedes, there's a lot of Europeans, but many of them are, in terms of racial materialism, yeah, they are Swedes, but they have absolutely no connection to the ethnicity of Sweden, because they're just rootless and cosmopolitan world citizens, basically. So there is a deeper meaning to ethnicity than just race. And I think Evola elaborates quite well on that, especially in terms of the quality of the soul, race of the soul, or race of the spirit, I mean. I read Weston Price, a North American dentist who went around in the world during last century and performed scientific research on Aboriginal populations in the world. But that's more related to health and stuff. So, but that was a really insightful book, at least I thought to mention it.
You cite Jonathan Bowden a few times in Dauntless. How much of an influence was he?
Oh, right. How could I? Yeah, exactly. I feel bad now for forgetting him. Yeah, definitely. I think he was really good listening to his speeches. And that's one of these things. I wish he would have, of course, lived longer, yeah, for his sake, and also for the sake of that he could have gotten out more of his wisdom and thoughts out there. So, it's one of my very good quotes. It's like about Islam. And he says that, you know, a lot of rightists and perennially minded people actually admire elements of Islam for their strength and fanaticism. And I thought that was quite a good quote. And I have it in the book as well. So yeah, Jonathan Bowden, definitely. I started appreciating him more as well when I started realizing the importance of culture as well.
Yeah, he was a huge influence on me as well. And I felt that we were just getting to be friends when he suddenly died. And I still think, my God, what a terrible loss. It's going on 8 years now since we lost him. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great loss for the entire Western world, I'd say. But luckily, we have still some of his speeches up on YouTube.
Yeah, I imagine all those will disappear. But I'm so grateful to the people who copy these things and mirror them and make sure they keep bouncing around out there. He's really educated a whole new generation of people since he died. People keep finding him. People tell me, I discovered this Bowden character. You actually knew him. Yeah. It makes me feel like some ancient grizzled ward veteran when they when they talk like that. So one of the things that you've been talking about recently in your most recent video that I saw was this epidemic, really, of violence against young Swedish men. And you're giving them advice about what to do about it. Can you tell us a little bit about this crisis and your take on it? And we'll also link your video.
Yeah, sure. So basically, this has come to the fore of Swedish debate as of late. But it's not something that is completely unique to Sweden. Basically, what we see is young Swedish youth, both girls and boys, but more boys, of course, they're getting beat up and robbed and humiliated in various ways by, well, basically non-Europeans, so mainly Africans and Arabs, etc. It breaks my heart. Of course, it breaks my heart to see it wherever it happens. It can be in Australia and America, in Sweden or Germany. It's always the same story. A white guy getting jumped, beaten up, humiliated. And I just wish these guys would stand up a bit more for themselves, fight back a bit more, and be loyal to each other. Because the perpetrators, the non-Europeans, they're always sticking together in groups. They attack in groups, whereas we have our individualism, so we act more as individuals. And it breaks my heart to see, because also I know there won't really be any punishment for the perpetrators. Of course, the long-term solution is to send them back to their own countries. We need a large-scale repatriation from Europe. The short-term solution is first and foremost to get these guys to stand up a bit more for themselves, just present themselves as anything but an easy victim. Because what I see now with these non-Europeans, not all non-Europeans, but these guys who are behaving this way, they see a white guy, they see a weak and easy target. And especially if you have some of these guys who've grown up with parents who are completely brainwashed. So there was an interview with a mother of a guy who had been robbed, beaten, and humiliated. And what she was concerned with was how she could help the robbers, how she could help them to feel better, because, oh, they behave this poorly because they must have had tough lives. So the brainwashing of a certain generation of Swedes is so brutally insane. And of course, they have raised their children to be passive victims, basically. So it is also a question about culture. It's a question about gender roles. It's a question about feminization of men, that fathers do not tell their sons to, you know, stand up for yourself. Instead, they're being told to just roll over and be nice and to be submissive. So it's really a heart-breaking story. And I just want to reach out to as many Swedish guys, to as many white guys as possible, who are teens who are living in these tough areas, that, you know, you need to be a bit more aggressive. You need to be a bit more assertive. You can't expect these people to leave you alone just because you show submission. They will only come at you harder. So that's a predicament we have in Sweden at the moment. And of course, it will take some time until we can maybe gain enough political influence to start repatriating these people. But in the meantime, it's a tough situation.
So tell me, what is your political solution for Sweden and more broadly for the white world?
Yeah, so basically the number one question is repatriation. Just getting people to leave again. They shouldn't have been here in the first place. They have no business being here. So that's the only... Of course, we have other important political issues, such as freedom of speech, of course. But in terms of just turning Sweden into a good country for everyone, it's just a matter of sending back a lot of people who have, in one way or the other, abused our hospitality. So Alternative for Sweden, which is a party that, their main thing is they promote repatriation, re-immigration. And they calculated it to maybe 500,000 people who are either living on welfare, haven't really made an effort to get into the Swedish society, or they have committed criminal acts. So we have a large part of the population that just haven't made any effort at all. So that's the first political and the most important political topic to restore some order to Sweden.
Yeah, I think that that makes sense. So are you more of an ethno-nationalist or one of these empire guys? I know empires are glorious and you like that kind of historical stuff. So what is your actual vision for the future of Europe?
Yeah, so basically I've gone more towards the empire view of things. And back before I used to be more of a Swedish nationalist, but I'm not really sure I can title myself as a Swedish nationalist anymore. And as I see it in Europe's case, I view it a bit as the Roman Empire. You know, you have the Western half, which is Western Europe now, and then you have the Eastern half, which is Eastern Europe. And I just hope that, you know, Eastern Europe can get as much help from the EU as possible to just build up, become strong, and keep their population and majority in their own countries. So if I feel blackpilled about Western Europe, I can look to the East and see, you know what, they are, if they are strong and blooming, yeah, we at least have that. So yeah, for me, I do, of course, have a supplement company and a clothing company, and I do, as it is right now, I'm doing business with Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Hungary. So I already have some ties out east. And yeah, it feels good. It feels good to support Eastern European economy. And yeah, both you and I have talked about the Intermarium project with Ukraine and other Eastern European countries. So for me, I just hope that whatever happens in the West, the East can at least stay strong.
Yeah, that's my hope as well. So you talk a lot about lifestyle, of course. That's one of your big things. You talk about politics and philosophy and lifestyle, how to improve yourself. You've had a big change in your life recently, and some of the attentive listeners have been hearing the little voice in the background. So can you talk a bit about becoming a dad?
Yeah, right. So she's being heard. Yeah, I heard her as well. We don't have such a big apartment, so you can hear her. Yeah, sure. It's been good. It's been good becoming a father. It of course, you become less flexible in terms of travel, especially since I've tried to be quite active in networking and going to events and holding speeches, etc. So I must say I'm a bit more tied down now, but I can still go out over the day to, you know, hold a seminar or do some training or attend events. Yeah, I can still do it, but otherwise it's just, yeah, you're more accountable to someone. And of course, certain things become a bit more harsh, such as the demonetization. It would have been one thing if I'm just alone, but if I have someone to provide for, it becomes a bit more it's a bit harder in that case, but ultimately it's all good. It feels nice.
Great. So you have another, I think, interesting discussion in the book about living in the countryside versus urban living. Would you talk a bit about that? I found that very interesting.
Yeah, sure. So basically, in terms of being more robust, being less fragile in the modern world, both in terms of if something should happen, like Guillaume Fay says, the convergence of catastrophes, if something should happen, an oil crisis or whatever. If you live in a city, yeah, you'll be out on thin ice if supply lines start, something happens to it. So that's one aspect. You can have, if you have your own animals, if you have chickens, hens, you can have eggs, you can hunt, for example, a bit more robust in that sort of way. Then also, if we're talking about a perhaps more civil war scenario, or a really, really deteriorating social situation where there is a lot of chaos on the streets, and we can see it even now, bad things happen in the city, but in the countryside, if you have a village of some sort and you have, say, five Swedish fathers who say, you know what, every Friday night or every whatever it might be. We go out with a car. We just keep a lookout on in the town or in the village. This would be very hard to do in a city. So you can have a much stronger sense of security if you live with like-minded people in a smaller place. And you have a much stronger sense of community as well, that you actually take care of each other. So I do think it's a good thing to live with like-minded people in one place, both in terms of, you know, survivalism if something should happen like that, or in terms of just staying safe from aggression from outsiders.
It's also, I think, in many ways more beautiful, of course, just to be closer to nature. You do get things in cities that are aesthetic experiences that you can't really get in the countryside. You know, live classical music, heroic sculptures, great architecture, you know, things like that. But you don't use that every day anyway. You don't see that every day generally. And you have to deal with, you have to wade through a lot of the negatives. So one thing you talk about, which I think is very, very interesting, is building circles of friends. And it's sort of a paradox, but it makes sense to me. I noticed that the loneliest people are the people who live in large cities. And one of the reasons why that happens, I think, is because when you live in a large city, you feel like you've got so many options that you never really sort of cultivate the people who are right in front of you. You think, well, you know, here's this guy, whatever, you know, we have this and that in common, but I'm sure there are other people out there that I click with even better. And so because you think you've got all these infinite options to find perfectly compatible people to be your circle of friends, you never actually develop a circle of friends because, well, you're always just keeping your options open. And that's one of the illusions that urban life offers. Whereas if you live in a small town or a small city, you don't have that sense of infinite options, and therefore there's a subtle pressure for you to make the best of what's in front of you. And therefore, odd as it may seem to urbanites, people who live in small towns have more friends. They have richer social lives. They have people they hunt with, that they train with, that they play cards with, that they go shopping with, things like that, that urbanites simply lack. Has that been your experience? Have you lived in cities versus countryside? Have you noticed that kind of dynamic in play?
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's a really good point. I have lived in, of course, when I was studying, I lived in Uppsala, which is, as you might imagine, a student town in Sweden. It's quite liberal, quite left-wing. So, I mean, it was fun. You know, we had good times studying together, etc. But they weren't people I would have any deeper sort of connection with. But I made the best of that situation. But I would say though that I had better friends in middle school, or what you call it. So from when you're 6 years to when you're 15 years, basically. And you know, that was also making the best out of the situation. We just got thrown into a class and we made good friends with the guys who were there. But then of course it was easy because they were guys like me. I went to an all Swedish schools basically all of my life. So it was easy to get friends like that. I definitely agree with what you're saying, that if you have a smaller place, you get to know people better, and it becomes a different atmosphere. I know in my gym experiences as well, I've trained on quite a few gyms over the years, and I would never want to train in a gym where, you know, an inner city gym, for example, no one says hello to each other, no one talks. You know, I'm not in the gym to talk, but I at least want to say hello, how are you, to the guys who are also training often, just because it creates a nicer atmosphere. And that's because, you know, it's local guys who train there. So yeah, definitely.
I do notice that even in cities in, say, Central and Eastern Europe, people are friendlier than they are in Western Europe. I do think that part of the breakdown in just sort of urban good manners and urban friendliness really has to do with multiculturalism and so forth. But there is, I think, also this attitude that, you know, well, they're more where you came from. You're not so special. You sort of look at every stranger and think, I'll never see this person again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And the great problem with that is that people aren't all that different, right? You think that, well, I'm a unique individual and there are going to be only a few people who are uniquely suited to be my friends. Well, as idiosyncratic as anybody may be, the fact is that if you put some effort into it, you can have good social relationships with practically anybody. And that's what narrowed sets of options force people to do. This is why, you know, if you belong to a church or something, or like you say, you're thrown into a classroom full of other kids just randomly, if you work at it, you can actually create really, really good social relationships in those sorts of settings. So I want to move on to a couple other topics.
Mm-hmm.
What are some things that you want new readers, new listeners to take away from this? What are the basics, I guess? I always want to come back to that. What are the basic things that you want to communicate with somebody? If you were just, you know, sort of thrown into an elevator with somebody, or, well, that's probably too limited a period of time, but say you're taking a short airplane ride with someone, and they look at you and they say, so what do you do? What are the basics you want people to know about you, the takeaway stuff that, you know, you hope can make an impact on people?
Right. So basically, I suppose it's mostly pro-European, pro-Western, pro-white people who are listening to this podcast. And to all of you, I would say that I've had revelation over the last few years that there are two types of people who are attracted to our ideas, negative and positive people. And we need to, you know, really create a good grounds for the positive side of us to grow, and for the negative to go back. So, you know, we should always act as gentlemen, always be polite, nice, present ourselves well. We live our ideology, and, you know, take a quite hard stance against antisocial behaviors, because, you know, when leftists, liberals, they say, you know, these pro-white guys, they're only haters and losers. Sometimes they're right, because there is a lot of antisocial tendencies in our circles, and we need to move away from it, because it, and I'm talking about hateful comments, basically unnecessary hateful comments. I'm not saying that you need to love the entire world, but I'm saying that you need to have a good rhetoric. You need to have a good language. You need to be polite, well presented, because a bad hateful language, it will detract good quality people from coming to us. I mean, if we want investors, which we all need, Countercurrents also needs, you know, people who support, then we want to present Countercurrents or my work in the that we're serious, positive people who want to create stuff, not just sit around being bitter and hateful. So that's a huge part, and that's also why I push, even in the political side of things or metapolitical, I push a lot on self-improvement, because then once you get that mindset, you will be a more pleasant person to be around, and, you know, be more sociable, etc. So I'd say that is at least what I would try to really push on if I was on a plane ride with some already pro-European guys.
Right. One thing that I think we need to grow away from is, well, irony. There are a lot of things about the internet culture, the internet alt-right, that were good, but there are a lot of things about it that I think we should leave behind.
Yeah, definitely.
One is just the lack of civility that the internet, I think, encourages. People just behave atrociously
Yeah.
online. They're jerks a lot of the time. And you can't really build a functional movement with a bunch of people who are sort of one-upping one another to be rude and obnoxious. You can't build anything from that. And the other thing is just the lack of earnestness, the lack of a sort of serious ethic. It's hard to tell what people really believe or what they really take seriously. And I do think that irony does have a certain space, a certain place, a certain role in this. If you create spaces where you can try on ideas without necessarily being committed to them, that actually makes it more likely that people will change their ideas. But if you want to change the world, you have to have a much more earnest ethos. And one of the things I really like about your work is that it's generally irony-free in that sense. You are one of the more earnest people that I know. And that's a very attractive trait. That's a very European trait. That's a very Aryan trait, to be earnest.
Oh, thank you. Very glad to hear it. It's a very good compliment. I agree. And, you know, we've been at this together for, as you said, we've known each other for a good few years now. And I'm sure you have written about it and you have discussed it before. I have done it too. And it bears repeating is the lack of civility. Just guys coming into the internet, they are frustrated and angry, which I understand. I'm also frustrated and angry a lot of times, but they come in and they use these channels, these forums as event. So they go online venting and writing a lot of really, really nasty stuff about other peoples or, individuals or whatever it might be. And it just looks so bad and it just puts our work back so much. For every time is someone who is curious on maybe our books, for example, and then they see comments saying, you know what, we should do this and that to this group of people, etc. Yeah, you know the comments I'm talking about, really hateful, and they do it because they want to vent their frustration online, but it's not really productive in the least. And then, of course, various insults to people who are actually putting their name and face out there. So it's been, to a large extent, a very toxic environment. And it's something we need to work on. And again, I have linked to your articles in regards to political violence. It's I've quoted you. It's worse than a crime. It's a mistake. And all sorts of antisocial behaviors are a mistake, simply put.
Yeah. Well, Marcus, this has been a very enjoyable time. I always enjoy talking to you. I've met you in Sweden. I've met you in the United States. I've met you in Ukraine. I hope we'll keep running into each other at these movement events and so forth.
Yeah, definitely.
I look forward to your next book and the next opportunity we have to do another Countercurrents Radio. I think we did one of these in, 2016 or 2017? And that proved to be a very popular interview. So,
all right, yeah, nice.
Can you say some things to plug your various enterprises, your various projects? How can people find more of you in social media, on the web, and so forth?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I have everything on my own page, thegoldenone.se. There you have all the links to social media, so Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. I don't really use Facebook anymore. I also have a Telegram channel, which you can find on the on the social media button on thegoldenone.se. So yeah, and then also, of course, The Golden One on YouTube. But again, all links are in the homepage.
It's always good to talk, and I hope you'll come back soon for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
Yeah, always a pleasure to be on.